So we meet the final parshios of Chumash Devarim. This week we have Nitzavim and Vayelech, very heady parshios. And of course, there's a great deal to say. They're compact, not too long, but of course, very dense. And the beginning of Parshas Nitzavim deals with a bris of sorts, as the pasuk says in the Yud Aleph La'avrucha b'bris Hashem Elokecha uva olaso, in order to have Bnei Yisrael pass through the covenant with Hashem. And according to certain Mefarshim, at least, this is really the wind down from the Tochacha, the second bris, which was, of course, reiterated last week in Parshas Kisavo. And it's very interesting to consider the quality and the nature of this bris that's being referred to in Parshas Nitzavim, and a great deal of insight into the nature of this parsha, these opening 20 or so psukim, can actually be gleaned from looking at the final pasuk in Perek Kaftes. That is to say, pasuk Kafches of Perek Kaftes. And as we will see, there's quite a variety of approach from Rishonim and Acharonim with regards to how to understand exactly this final pasuk, pasuk Kafches. The pasuk reads, Hanistoros Lashem Elokeinu, that which is hidden, that's for Hashem. Vaniglos, that which is revealed, Lanu Ulvanenu, that's for us, for our descendants, Ad Olam, for always. Laasos Eskol Divrei HaTorah Hazos. So to read and translate the pasuk is relatively straightforward, but to understand how these words form the conclusion of the discussion of the bris, that needs more investigation. How does it conclude by saying, after all is said and done, the bottom line, the moral of the story is, that which is hidden for Hashem, that which is revealed for us, that is that which is hidden, what which is hidden? What which is revealed? For a pasuk that talks about the hidden and the revealed, the pasuk itself is somewhat enigmatic. What are the nistoros? What are the niglos? Also interesting, of course, we cannot help but notice on the words lanu ulvanenu, and on the ayin of ad, you have these dots, and that's part of a mesorah. And if you look in the Sefer Torah, where there's no punctuation, but those dots are there. And So let's begin what for us will be the beginning with the Perush of Ramban. And again, all of the Mefarshim, each one in their own way, will be looking to explain what are the Nistoros, hidden from whom? What are the Niklos, revealed to whom? And Ramban explains Al Derech HaPshat. What is the bris about? On the simplest level, the bris is about the keeping of the mitzvahs and avoiding of averus. That's the tochacha, im shamoa tishma, im lo tishma, with all the consequences that ensue therefrom. And says Ramban, it's important to qualify at this concluding stage what exactly is included within the bris. And what he means to say is, a person may make a mistake, thinking that here is the Torah saying, if you do the wrong thing, you'll be punished. If you do the right thing, you'll be rewarded. Well, a person, let us hope, wishes to avoid doing the wrong thing. He doesn't wish to sin. But what should happen if he unwittingly does a sin that he doesn't realize? And he may feel that he's also being targeted by the bris. I mean, rules are rules. Do the wrong thing, it's the wrong thing, regardless of whether or not you know. But that's important to address that point. Because if a person feels that he'll be punished even for something that he didn't really know was wrong, he may get into a different type of relationship with the bris whereby he feels that it's not fair. And moreover, untenable. Because no one knows everything, we do our best, and we're all learning, and we're a work in progress. But for a person to think, even if I don't know, and honestly don't know, and still did the wrong thing, and I'll still be punished, that seems to be maybe unreasonable. And it is critically important that a person never think that the Torah has made unreasonable demands on him. Because if that's the case, firstly, it's not true. And secondly, it can lead to despair. It can lead to despondency, because the moral of the story is, you'll never win, right? That someone is going to get you somewhere, even if you try your best. And that's not a Torah perspective at all. And to that end, says Rambam, the Parsha concludes, there has been a great deal of detail about the punishment for wrongdoing. But the final word is to distinguish between nistaros and niglos. Nistaros, that which is hidden, says the Pasuk, Lashem Elokeinu. So that's for Hashem. As if to, and nistaros, hidden from whom? Says Ramban, hidden from the person himself. He does something that's not right, but he doesn't realize. That's called nistaros. The true nature of his deed is hidden from him, because he doesn't know. And actually, says Ramban, if you look elsewhere in Tanakh, you will find that the word nistaros actually refers to wrongdoings that the person does not know that they are wrong. Unwitting wrongdoings. Where do we find this? In Tehillim. In Perek Yotes, it's the first of the chapters that we add for Psukah Desimra on Shabbos, where David HaMelech says, Shkios miyavin, who can fully know shkios, matters of error, ministoros nakeni, cleanse me from nistaros. And when he talks about nistaros, he's saying things that he has done wrong that he doesn't know about. He's saying, cleanse me from them as well. One doesn't like to have them. But what we do see is that the term nistaros refers to things that a person doesn't know they're wrong. And placing that definition back into our parsha, therefore, it concludes by saying, a person is not accountable in that tochacha way to things that are nistaros, but he is for niglos, and things that are revealed to him, things that he knows are wrong. And at that point, the bris again becomes eminently doable and reasonable. Of course, the moral of the story is not that a person should endeavor to have as much unknown to him as possible in order to avoid negative consequences, because if a person can learn and doesn't learn, that's worse. And he ends up ignorant of Torah, which is worse than anything. they say ignorance is bliss, but ignorance is a high price to pay, even for bliss. As the Mishnah says in Pirkei Avos, Shigagas Talmud, Ola Zodin, if a person neglects to learn, acceptable at all. There are two types of mistake. There are honest mistakes and dishonest mistakes. But if it's an honest mistake, that's called nistaros. And the Torah says, don't feel victimized and don't feel that it's impossible and you'll try your best and you didn't know and you'll still be punished. Not so. Nistaros l'shem Elokeinu. Only the niglos are lanu ulevaneinu. Now, what's important to note, and thus far we have the approach of the Ramban, what's important to note is that according to the Ramban, the issue of nistaros and niglos are actions whose nature is revealed or concealed from the person himself, from the one who's doing them. But as we will see, we will move to another approach, which is actually Rashi's approach, based on Chazal, the Gemara in Sanhedrin, where it's about things that are withheld that someone else does that you are not aware of. And let us. Rashi will speak for himself. Pasuk Kaf Ches, Hanistaros L'Hashem Elokeinu. That which is hidden is for Hashem. V'im Tomru, Rashi elaborates. May perhaps you'll say, Ma Biyadeinu La'asos. What can we do? Again, it's an atmosphere which I think is encapsulated by the modern Hebrew expression which says Zelo Fair. It can't work. Ma biyadeinu la'asos, what can we do? Atamanish es harabim al hirhurei hayachid, because you hold the community accountable for even the thoughts, the wayward thoughts of the individual, which seems to be the case here. And what Rashi is saying is that what's being introduced in this bris is inter-responsibility, accountability of people for each other. Perhaps the earlier bris, and we'll discuss this a little bit more, perhaps the earlier bris was in a sense, each person purely accountable for himself. If someone else is doing something wrong, it's not my problem. Enter the bris of Chumash Devarim, it is your problem. However, as soon as someone else becomes my problem and I'm responsible for them and accountable for them, but what if I have no idea what they're doing? I'm still accountable for them? That's not fair. That can't be. To that end, the Parsha concludes, Ein ani ma'anish eschem al hanistoros. If it's not known to you, it's something that the other person is thinking or doing and you don't know, that's Lashem Elokeinu. That which is hidden is Lashem Elokeinu. V'hu yipara me'oso yachid. And he will deal with that person. But there's niglos. There's things which are revealed. There's things that are well known. And you could do something. You could help. Or you could protest. Or you could encourage. Aval haniglos lanu ulevaneinu. That is for the community. The wrongdoing of each person is the responsibility of the community. Leva'er hara mikirbeinu. To uproot wrongdoing from our midst. And if no one does anything, then the community is accountable. Inactivity is no longer acceptable. Now, so we see that according to Rashi, in contrast with Ramban, to remain clear, that with the nistaros is not a person's own deeds, the true nature of which is hidden from himself, but someone else's deeds, which are hidden from everybody else. That's Lashem Elokeinu. Now what's interesting is, Rashi then proceeds to discuss the dots. And again, it's from the Gemara. Nakud, there are dots on the words Lanu Ulevaneinu. And what do those dots mean? Because we're introducing the idea of Achrayus, what's called Kol Yisrael Arevim Zeh Lazeh. The Jewish people are responsible for each other. It happens to be that responsibility was only formally activated when we entered Eretz Yisrael and we had the whole thing with Har Gizim and Har Eval, and that's when people become responsible for each other. But Moshe's not going to be there. So he has to talk about it now, but it's not until then. And that comes out in the dots. Rashi explains. Nakud, there's dots on the words Lanu Ulevaneinu, Lidrosh, to expound. Sha'afal haniglos lo onishes harabim. Even that which is revealed with other people, the rabbim are not punished. Ad she'over es hayarden, until they cross the Yarden into Eretz Yisrael. Mishikiblo aleim es hashavua b'har grizim u'b'har eval, when they accept the full shavua, har grizim and har eval, benasu arevin zeh lazeh, and they become responsible one for the other. And that happened actually very quickly. I think we have an episode of that in the Battle of Ai, right, with Yericho. Achan, he did something wrong. Other people were held accountable for it. Everyone, Kol Yisrael, Arevim Zeh Lazeh. And that we get from the dots. The question is, how do we get it from the dots? I mean, dots are, well, they're dots kishmam. How do they give a message, and how does the message come across? Again, to be clear, the message is, even though we're saying that which is revealed is for us, we're accountable, but not yet. And that aspect of not yet comes through in the dots. How so? So here we find two fascinating approaches among Mefarshim. Maharal, in the Gur Aryeh, explains that the dots here are functioning in the way that dots normally function. We know about this. Chazal talk about this. There are other places in the Torah where there are dots on top of letters. And what the dot comes to do is it comes to somehow lessen the impact of the word. It comes to detract from the full expression of the word. The dots are mema'it. Okay. It's interesting to note, Rashi says that the dots are on Lanu Ulevaneinu. That's a general description. It happens to be that the dots, if you look at the Pasuk, and this is one of those occasions where seeing dots is a good thing, Lanu Ulevaneinu, there's dots on those words and letters, and also on the Ayin of Ad. There are 11 in total. Lanu Ulevaneinu and the Ayin of Ad. So that's interesting, because you've got two words that are fully have dots on them, and then Ad, half of it does. So that's an interesting place to stop. It's such a short word, and you stop halfway through. And how does all of this contribute to our understanding? Well, again, says Maharal, the role of dots is to somehow lessen the impact of what's saying. And that's really what's happening here. Because although it's Lanu Ulevaneinu, it's for us, we're accountable, but not yet. and therefore it's coming to qualify, it's coming to diminish, in a sense, what seems to be the full meaning of the word. If you just had the words lanu levanenu, the understanding would be from now. But it's not true. It's not from now. It's only from shortly, another few weeks or whatever. And therefore, that detraction from the full meaning of the word comes through the dots, because dots detract. There's only one thing. If dots detract, you know, you can detract in many different directions. And detract just means less than the full meaning of the word. But it can be less in many different ways. And we're saying it's specifically less in terms of time frame. It won't happen straight away. It's less in that respect. But maybe it's less in another respect. Certain situations, yes. Certain situations, no. All I know is that it's not across the board. But how do I know that that board is a chronological board? Says Maharal, that's why the dots, with their lessening connotation, continue until the word ad. Because the word ad already gives you the measure of which aspect is being diminished, which aspect is being qualified. Ad is a reference to the future. And therefore what we're saying is, it's something about the future that is being detracted from here. Namely, it does not happen straight away until all time, but rather only after a certain while. There's an aspect of the future that's being carved out through these dots. But one should we ask, well, which time frame? I now know that there's a time in the future where it won't apply. But how do I know that's the immediate future until Har Grizim and Har Eval? And that's why, says Maharal, it stops at the ayin of ad, because the ayin is the first part of ad, which tells you that it is the first part of the future that is being diminished from this. Namely, now we're ready to put it all together. The reference is to the now until Har Grizim and Har Eval, the first slice of the future, from now until then, the short term until then. What you can say in dots, one doesn't need to say in words. So this is the approach of Maharal to understanding how the dots speak, right? The language of dots in that way. Diminishing, but diminishing in terms of time, and diminishing in terms of the future, and diminishing in terms of the immediate future. That's our result. Amazingly, Tosfos, because this comes from the Gemara in Sanhedrin, I think on Daf Mem Gimel, Tosfos there have a very different approach, very different, and as we will see. For if we would describe, we would say like this. The Pasuk says, distinguishes between nistaros, things that you don't know, and that's not your problem, that's Hashem's problem, that someone else is doing. Niglos, if you know about it, it is your problem. But that's only true from a certain time, Har Grizim and Har Eval. Until that time, it's still not your problem. If we say that Arevus only happens in a few weeks' time, that means in the interim time, it's still not your problem. So whose problem is it before it becomes your problem? It's Hashem's problem. Which means that there are two things that are Hashem's problem. Number one, hidden things, always, because you don't know. Number two, revealed things for a while, until they become your problem. So, says Tosfos, as we said, there are 11 dots on these words, lanu ulevanenu. Why 11? Says Tosfos, don't look at the letters underneath to see a relationship between the dot and what's underneath it. The reason why there's 11 dots is because it corresponds to the 11 letters in the words Lashem Elokeinu. 5 in Lashem, 6 Elokeinu. As if to say, according to Tosfos, and I've never seen anything like this before or since, these dots function as what we would call ditto marks. As if to say, Hanistoros, always, Lashem Elokeinu. If you don't know, it's never your problem. What about Niglos? Is that your problem? The answer is, yes, but not yet. And how is that communicated? Because alongside the words which say, Lanu Levanenu, there's dots, which say dot, 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 meaning they're also Lashem Elokeinu, a repetition of Lashem Elokeinu, because in the short term, before Arevus kicks in, it's still Lashem Elokeinu. So you have a text and a subtext, or an ubertext, whereby accompanying Lanu Levanenu is a sotto voce Lashem Elokeinu for the intervening, intermittent weeks. So that's quite a different approach altogether, and the result is the same. Namely, it's about Arevos, it's about the Jewish people together. And the truth is, what emerges from this parsha is the issue of Arevos. The Jewish people are in it together. And it's for this reason, as we've quoted in the past, the Vilna Gaon notes, this is really what's behind the one of the major distinctions between the second Tochacha, which is in Kisavo, and which we're capping now, and the first Tochacha in Bechukosai. They're largely similar in idea, Brachos and Klalos, but one of the key differences is that Bechukosai is written in the plural, in Bechukosai Telechu, in Bechukosai Timasu, and in contrast, in the singular, Im Shamoa Tishma, Im Lo Tishma. What is represented by the shift of the Torah addressing the Jewish people from Lashon Rabim to Lashon Yochid? Well, the Vilna Gaon in the Sefer Aderes Eliyahu says that the difference between Lashon Rabim and Lashon Yochid, it's not when the Torah talks in the singular, it's only talking to one person and everybody else is just excluded. Rather, they're both talking to the entire Jewish people, but Lashon Rabim talks to each and every individual of the Jewish people as individuals. It's a group of people. Lashon Yochid talks about the Jewish people as one entity called Am Yisrael. And that is true. Interestingly, the Vilna Gaon doesn't mention it, but clearly supported by the words of Chazal themselves. There are two mitzvahs to count in the Torah. There's the mitzvah of counting the Omer, and there is the mitzvah of counting the years of Shemitah and Yovel. The Omer is in Parshas Emor, Shemitah is in Parshas Behar. Now, interestingly, the mitzvah of counting the Omer is for everyone, as we know. Everyone has a mitzvah of Sfiras Omer. The mitzvah of counting the Shemitah and Yovel is not for everyone. Even the farmer doesn't have to count. Who counts the Shemitah and Yovel years? Says the Sifrei, just the Bezdin. The Bezdin counts. So how do I know if there's a mitzvah? I mean, the Torah says count. So how do I know if I'm meant to count, each individual, or the Bezdin can count and is like almost motzi everyone? How do I know? The answer, says Tosfos in Sukkah, Daf Mem Aleph, is very simple. Because the mitzvah of Sfiras HaOmer is written in the plural. Usfartem lachem. If it's in the plural, it applies to each and every person. As the Gemara says in Menachos Daf Samach Vav, Sheteh Sfira Bepi Kol Echad VeEchad. Each and every person needs to count. In contrast, the mitzvah of counting Shemitah is in the singular, v'safarta lecha. If it's in the singular, it addresses the Jewish people as one entity, and therefore as one entity, who counts? The Bezdin, which represent the entire Jewish people. So that halachic distinction really bears out what the Vilna Gaon is saying. And therefore, whereas the earlier bris, again in Bechukosai, it's in the plural, it's to each and every individual because it's really addressing them as individuals. A group of individuals, but individuals nonetheless. Whereas the bris of last week's parsha, which we're concluding now, is in the singular because it's Am Yisrael as one entity. Because all of a sudden you need to be conscious of other people also and possibly accountable for them. You have to look out for them. You're responsible for them. And very interestingly, I came across this recently. They published a volume in English of a Divrei Torah from Rav Herschel Schachter, who is the Rosh Kollel there in YU. And he himself is, of course, a great, outstanding Talmid Chacham. And this is no doubt a fraction of the Torah that comes out, but it's a start. And he has a wonderful observation. Because the truth is that one of the developments or new ideas of this bris of Nitzavim is mentioned explicitly in the Pasuk. Where? Pasuk Yud Gimel and Pasuk Yud Dalet. Let's take a look. Pasuk Yud Gimel and Pasuk Yud Dalet. So that's Sheni. The aliyahs are very short. I think the Baal Kore, it's fair to say, on Monday and Thursday, if no one stops him, he can finish the parsha before looking back. So Pasuk Yud Gimel. V'lo itchem levatchem anochi kareses abris hazos ve'asala hazos. It's not just with you that this covenant is being cut, being set. Rather, Pasuk Yud Dalet, ki es asheyesh no po imanu omet hayah. For it's with people that are here, standing here together, and also people that are not here, generations to come, the bris is also with them. So it's very interesting because this is explicitly stated that it's for present generation, future generations, but it's stated in the second bris. It's not stated in the first bris, and it seems to be almost a point of distinction between them. But the question is, why is that so? So if Schachter says very wonderfully, you can't enact a covenant with someone who's not there. Only with someone who's in front of you. So now the question is, when as generations come and go, and a few generations down the line, or however many generations down the line, were they there when the covenant was enacted? It depends. You see, if the bris is, if the covenant is with individuals, so individuals, they exist within themselves. The next generation are different individuals, and they weren't there at the bris. And therefore, as long as the Jewish people are looked upon as individuals, each generation is a new set, is a new entity almost, new group of individuals. And therefore, it could never be fully enunciated that this bris is for everyone, for future generations as well. Because how could it impact them in formal sense? However, that changes in last week's parsha, because when you move from the group of individuals to the community, to the unity, which is the Jewish people are always there. And if you are addressing that unified entity called the Jewish people, however many generations down the line you go, it will still be the Jewish people. There's a very interesting moshul which is given by Rav Shimon Schwab, actually, in a different context, but about this matter. He discusses, you know, a person exists as long as he exists, even though a person is made up of cells, and those cells are constantly replenishing themselves and constantly being renewed, which means that the millions and millions of cells within a person, when you meet him, however many weeks it is, 2-3 weeks or whatever it is, none of the cells that were there, you know, a month ago are there now. From that point of view, he's an entirely new person, but he isn't. Because he's one entity, the parts of which are constantly being renewed, but the entity is there. And he described it rather graphically. He says when he was a child, he got some scalding water, kind of fell on him and scalded him. He says none of those cells are there anymore, but it still hurts when I think about it, because it's still the same person. And similarly here, once the Jewish people are addressed in a sense as Guf Echad, that group is still there. The Jewish people today are the same Jewish people. The cells have changed, but the entity is the same, and the bris that was cut with them still exists. That's the fascinating idea of Rav Schachter, which is again based on the Vilna Gaon's noting of the shift from the plural to the singular. Thus far, let us take stock. We have seen two approaches to understanding the idea of Nistoros and Niglos. Again, to state them. For the Ramban, Nistoros are, it's within the person, things that are Nistar for him about his own conduct versus things that he knows about. For Rashi, it's more interpersonal, things that someone else is doing that I'm also responsible for, either that I don't know about or do know about. And this brings us to our third Peirush. And this Peirush actually comes from the Ramban. And there's an interesting history to this Peirush, because Rabbeinu Bachya quotes it, and he quotes it twice. He quotes it in his Peirush to this pasuk, not surprisingly, Anistoros, and he quotes it in the name of the Ramban. Elsewhere, in a sefer of Rabbeinu Bachya, which is called Kat HaKemach, and Kat HaKemach is actually a sefer that discusses topics in Torah, and it's organized alphabetically, which although for us is a very intuitive thing, it was the first of its, or of the early ones of its kind, to the idea of systematically going through Aleph Beis topics, whatever it may be, and when he comes to letter Samach and he discusses Sukkah, we won't discuss now how this comes to be part of his discussion of Sukkah, but he quotes again this Peirush of the Rambam, which we will say in just a moment, but he also adds that this I heard in the name of the Rambam from his Peirush on the which we were not zoche to see in our lands, which I mean from Egypt to Spain is not that far, but in those days everything is far, and we were not zoche to see it, which is actually very interesting because we were not aware otherwise that the Rambam has a Peirush on the Chumash. And he wrote everything else. But the Rabbeinu Bachya says he has a Peirush on the Chumash. I heard this quoted from his Peirush on the Chumash. I've never seen the Peirush. We weren't zochah to have it. So this is the one gem that remains. And what does the Rambam say? Rambam says, says Rabbeinu Bachya, that the reference, and again, we're looking at this final pasuk, pasuk kafches, what's nistaros, what's niglos. Rambam says, every mitzvah contains within it hidden ideas. No question about that. There are endless levels of depth to what the mitzvah is. A person may be inclined to make a mistake, and that is to feel that if I apprehend or connect with the idea, this hidden idea within the mitzvah, then maybe I don't need to do the mitzvah because I've got the idea. I get the message. In other words, the one danger, shall we say, of a person hearing that there's mitzvahs to be done is he may feel, yes, perhaps the practical application of mitzvahs are for those who don't really understand what's inside the mitzvah. They need the practice of the mitzvah. But I, yours truly, the maven, understand what's the mitzvah, and therefore maybe I can just go with the nistaros, that which is within the mitzvah, and not with the revealed actual practical aspect of the mitzvah, which is flawed, of course, for so many reasons. Firstly, as much as a person feels that he's confident that he gets the reason for the mitzvah, one can never fully know what's in the mitzvah. And secondly, even if you have successfully arrived at something within the mitzvah that is not necessarily the subtotal of what's in the mitzvah, lahavdil, even an intelligent person may tell you to do something for more than one reason. Kal vachomer, the infinite intelligence, there are unknown numbers of reasons, some of which you know, some of which you don't. As if to say, you'll never know if you're 100% right. And even if you're 100% right, it doesn't mean it's 100% of the equation. So there will always be more for the mitzvah on so many different levels. And to that end, says the Rambam, that's why the pasuk concludes, there's mitzvahs, and don't abuse the idea of the mitzvah by saying it's a substitute for the fulfillment of the mitzvah. At the end of the day, hanistaros l'Hashem Elokeinu, the full measure of that which is hidden in the mitzvah is beyond you anyway. Only Hashem knows exactly what's in the mitzvah and the totality of what's in the mitzvah, which means v'haniglos, that which is revealed, that's lonu l'vaneinu lasos. That's important to state just before the bris ends. People shouldn't take liberties in terms of the concept of tamei hamitzvahs. To do what we would call tam ki ikar, to borrow a phrase from Kashrus, that the reason becomes like the ikar and performance of the mitzvah gets pushed to the side. What's interesting is, in this respect, it's fascinating to see how this idea that a person may feel that somehow mitzvahs are not applicable to him, amazingly, is also described earlier in the parsha, according to the Ksava Kabbalah. Let's have a look at Pasuk Yud Ches. Well, it really begins in Pasuk Yud Zayin, where Moshe says, you know, perhaps this is an individual who's thinking wayward thoughts and thinking somehow, as he says in Yud Zayin, Pen yesh bachem, isho, isho, mishpacha, oshemet, asher levavo poneh hayom me'im Hashem elokeinu. Laleches lavodes elohei agoyim ahem. Maybe he wishes to have a different course. Now, what about the mitzvahs? So Pasuk Yud Ches says, v'haya, now when he hears this curse, meaning the covenant, the terms and conditions, shalom, he will, if you translate literally, he will bless himself, as if to say, reassure himself in his heart, to say, I'll be fine. Now, without yet translating, it sounds like you have a person, he has the metal, the temerity to be addressed with the curses of not keeping the mitzvah, but somehow he thinks, I'll be okay. The question is, how does he figure? Where does that come from? What in the tochacha gives him to think that he'll be okay if he doesn't keep the mitzvah? It really doesn't sound that way. If that's his conclusion, upon hearing the tochacha, he should hear it again in a language that he understands. So what is the meaning of this person? Where is he coming from? I'll be fine. How can he bless himself in his heart? How can he reassure himself? So the answer must be within the words, ki bishrirus libi eilech. What is the meaning of the words shrirus libi? So some may translate the word shrirus from the word shriruti, which is like, I can do what I want, which again, you know, that's Darf McKennan. How did he get that conclusion from? But the Ksava Kabbalah says, and I think it's also a very accepted translation, Bishri Rusli Bi is the way my heart sees. The word shrirus is an expression of vision. Bishrirus libi. The root is the word shur. Shur is to see. Vatabet eini bishurai. Right? I behold those who see me. Bishurai. Or as Bilam says, ashurenu velo karo. Lashur is to see. Also, benos tada ali shur. The brachos of Yaakov. And therefore, lashur is to see. Aha. So what does he mean? He can go the way his heart sees. Why? Says the Ksava Kabbalah, whenever the Torah doubles over a word, like a key letter, it means to intensify the idea. Lashur is to see. Everyone can see. But this person feels he can do more than see. He can super see. Everyone else is in shur or sheer, shirus libi, but he is shirus libi. He is convinced that he has intense, unerring vision, infallible vision. Shirus libi means my heart has supervision. And what can I see? Everything in its most correct and moral possible light. As if to say, the person, he blesses himself and reassures himself by saying, I'll be fine. I don't have to necessarily follow the rules because bishrirus libi. The good news is my heart has amazing vision. It can see so clearly that I'm pretty sure that whatever I do will be morally correct without ever having to check in with the rules. That's where it comes from. And when you think about it, that's very similar to the Rambam. The Rambam says he feels he knows what's inside the mitzvahs and he gets it, and therefore perhaps he doesn't need to actually do the mitzvahs. Here the Ksava Kabbalah in his way is saying, that's what the person is saying in Pasuk Yud Ches, Bishrirus Libi. And I'd like to add actually something on this Ksava Kabbalah. This individual who's convinced, because of course, what's the flaw in what he's saying? Everyone's convinced that they see everything right. Kol derech ish yasher be'eino. Everyone feels that they are the bastion of cosmic truth. And really, it's their opinion. But ego says, my opinion is the truth. Then there is no other way. If there is another way, it's the wrong way. And that naturally accrues to the person. So wherever he goes, he just assumes that it's right because that's what he thinks. It's something of the mutation, the famous cognito ergo sum, I think, therefore I am. In this states, I think, therefore I am right. If I think it, then by definition, it's right, because I thought it. So for him, it makes perfect sense. Albert Einstein famously said, what we call common sense is the collection of prejudices acquired by the age of 18. You can't imagine anyone sees anything differently, and it becomes common sense. That's shrirus libi thing. Although not in those words. But I'd like to add just a fascinating idea. He says, Bishrirus libi eleich. Sometimes the word leiv can appear with one base, libi. Sometimes it can appear with two bases, levavi. And also libcha and levavcha. What is the connotation of having two bases in the word levavcha? Well, of course, we're mindful of the famous statement of the Mishnah in Maseches Brachos, commenting on the opening of Shema, Va'ahavta et Hashem Elokecha b'chol levavcha. So it says, Shalav Hashem b'chol levavcha, with all your heart. And the Mishnah darshans, there's two bases, b'chol levavcha, b'shnei yitzarecha, with both of your yetzers, yetzer tov and yetzer hara. How do you love Hashem with your yetzer hara? That's another question. But everything somehow has got to be brought in. What we see for our purposes is that the term levav is a reference to, in a sense, the full heart, both with both yetzers being represented, yetzer tov and yetzer hara. Lev with one base is just the one, just yetzer tov. And we see, therefore, that really part of what this person is saying, go back to his words, he says, bishrirus libi. You know why my vision is so clear? Because I see with my heart, and it only has one base in it. I am guided entirely by my yetzer tov. So I cannot fail. Everything I see is by definition morally correct because it's guided by the moral part within me. If I only see with libi, with my yetzer tov, so I have supervision, bishrirus libi. There's just one problem. It's a great idea, but where does it come from? We back up a few words in the pasuk. It says, v'hisparech bilvavo lemor. he'll reassure himself with his heart. Two bases, meaning this amazing utopian idea of being able to see with the Yetzer Tov. It's a great idea. You know where it comes from? From the Yetzer Hara. He is the one that gets the person. His greatest triumph is to convince the person that you only see with your Yetzer Tov. I don't exist. And then he can retire after that point. Because the person then proceeds convinced that he cannot fail. He cannot err. So it would be wonderful for a person to see only with his Yetzer Tov. Currently, that idea only exists as a fiction coming directly from the Yetzer Hara. When your Livavo tells you that you see with Libo, you have a problem. One could almost say that the pasuk is almost like a conservation of matter, whereby most people see with one resh because they see with both bases. But his person thinks he only sees with one base, and that's how he gets two reshes. If it's only my Yetzer Tov, I've got Shrirus Libi. But it's not true. There's two bases. And therefore, ultimately, the entire idea, to use an expression, is without basis. So, these are some of the discussions of what this person is thinking. And I'd like to conclude with a very beautiful interpretation. It's the fourth interpretation, the fourth and final, I should say, again, of these words. And what have we seen? That analyzing the final pasuk of Hanistoros, we get a sense of what the entire parsha was about. It caps the parsha, and in a sense, it gives us a sense of what the parsha is about. Hanistoros l'shem Elokeinu. According to the Psikta, which is a collection of midrashim, this pasuk is connected to the pasuk that comes just before it, which are again difficult psukim, which describe the Jewish people. They went astray, and they were thrown out of Eretz Yisrael. And pasuk Kaf Zayin states, "Vayitshem Hashem el Admosam Hashem." Got rid of them. And he threw them out. He hurled them out into some other land. Until this very day. I mean, until further notice. And that's it. And that could happen. And it has happened. And the final pasuk is really just addressing that. Because when the Jewish people are in Golus, it's only natural for them to think, well, when's it going to end? And when will the Geula come? And then they maybe start trying to work it out. And they may be convinced that they've got it right. And a lot of the energy becomes focusing on discovering the date of the Geula. And the Psikta itself says, you can never know. That's why it concludes, Hanistoros, certain things are hidden. And one of the things that are hidden is, when is Hayom HaZeh over? You don't know. And you don't want to say that it's going to be today, for all the reasons that are well known. And that's not where your energy should be focused. And thus it concludes by saying, there are certain things that are hidden. Leave that for Hashem, when the Geula will come. So then the question is, so there's nothing for me to do? There's plenty for you to do. You can bring it closer. And Niglos, there's plenty revealed. And in a sense, that's part of the problem, one could say, with all of these fixations on, you know, when will the Geula come? It's all about that, and not about actually keeping mitzvahs, which are the thing that will facilitate it. And thus the parsha concludes, Nistaros l'Hashem Elokeinu, leave that for Hashem. Haniglos, plenty for you to do, to make it happen. Haniglos l'anu v'aleinu, l'asus is called the Riata Razos. And thus, if we could conclude this opening part of the Shir, we would say that we have seen four Perushim, we could borrow the expression, Misham Yipared, Vahyal Arba Arashim. We have seen four understandings of what are the Nistaros and the Niglos that the Parsha is referring to. According to Ramban, again, it's that which is hidden and revealed to the person about his own actions. According to Rashi, it's that which is hidden or revealed to the person about someone else's actions, wrongdoings. According to Rambam, it's the hidden and reveals aspect of the mitzvahs, what to focus on. And according to the Psikta, it is about the Geula, the date of which is hidden, but the way to which to bring it about is manifestly revealed. So that's with regards to the opening of the Parsha. I'd like to just turn our attention now to what's called the Parsha of Tshuva, which is the second half of Nitzavim. I have to leave by Yelech Mitzvah Hashem for another time. And I'd like to open by referring to two statements of in the Gemara, in Maseches Yuma, of course, in the end of Yuma, Daf Pei Vav and Pei Zayin, there's a lot of discussion about tshuva. There are two statements, and they are about tshuva, and specifically the relationship between tshuva and geula. And they state, the first one says, Gedola tshuva shemikarevis is a geula, right? Great is tshuva, brings the geula close. Shine emar, quotes a pasuk, Shimru mishpat v'asu tzedaka. Act correctly. With mishpat v'tzedaka, ki krova Yeshua si lako. Because the Yeshua is near. And what that means is you bring it near through acting correctly. Gedola tshuva shemikareves is a geula. There is another statement really nearby in that Gemara which says Gedola tshuva shesmucha legeula. Tshuva is great that it is close to geula, samuch. So now, in a sense, the question is, what is the difference in connotation between these two very similar sounding statements in the Gemara? One says that tshuva mekareves ha-geula, one says that tshuva is smucha le-geula. But is that sounds like two ways of saying the same thing? And there is a very profound explanation of these two comments of the Gemara, which is in the Sefer Akedas Yitzchak. Akedas Yitzchak of Rabbi Yitzchak Arama, one of the major works from the later Rishonim, and this discussion of Yitzchak Arama is somewhat in Nechama Leibovich's Sefer Aleh Shalom, so one could look there as well. If you look at the Parsha, that is to say, if you look at Perek Lamed, you'll see as a general comment, it seems to go back and forth, shall we say, between tshuva and geula. Goes back and forth in the sense that it seems to open with tshuva. For example, pasuk beis, v'shavta ad Hashem Elokecha v'shamata b'kolo, tshuva, and then it moves into really geula, because pasuk gimel, v'shav Hashem Elokecha shivuscha v'richamecha, Hashem will bring you back. Will collect you from all the nations. Psukim that are well known to us, wherever far flung you'll be. Right, that's kibbutz galios, that's geula. And then it goes back to tshuva, because if you look in pasuk vav, umal Hashem lokechas levavchas v'eslavzerecha. And pasuk ches ba'atatashuv, you'll return b'shamata b'kol Hashem. So it's quite clear in the order of the psukim. It's tshuva, geula, tshuva. But what does that mean? The Akedas Yitzchak he illustrates with a simple moshel. Sometimes you can have a situation where a person has a problem, or maybe more than one problem, and the two problems feed on each other. It's difficult to know how he's going to get out of it. If you have lo aleinu, a person who's very, very sick. So he has no koach, and he has no appetite. And therefore, it's difficult. Because if he doesn't eat, he's not going to have any strength. But he doesn't even have the strength to eat. So what do you do? So the Akedas Yitzchak says, you've got to do something. And typically what might be done is, Get him to move, even more than he wants to. Because what are you doing? That's not going to heal him. I mean, he has serious, much more serious problems than that. A bit of movement is not going to make a difference. But if you get him to move and to exert himself just a little bit, at the very least, it could bring back the appetite, which will then allow him to eat once again, and he's back. He's back in, and then things can play off each other and reinforce each other. So, what that means is, you could almost say that Golus is, it can't be the solution, even for what brought it about. As if to say, Golus is a result of not behaving correctly in Eretz Yisrael. That's a mild way of putting it. So, then how do you do tshuva? How do you fix it? Well, you fix it by doing tshuva, and yes, living correctly. However, says Akedas Yitzchak, there's a problem. Because there's only a certain level of Jewish living that you can reach in Golus. So you're in a place where you can never fully fix the problem. But on the other hand, The only place that you can fully fix the problem is Eretz Yisrael, but you were thrown out for a reason. So how does it begin? What's the antidote? What happens is one needs almost like that first move of tshuva. It's got to start with tshuva. You can't be brought back to that. It's got to start with tshuva. But it doesn't end with tshuva, because there's only so much tshuva you can do in Golus. Because tshuva means we'll live as the Jewish people should, but you're limited, because it's not Eretz Yisrael. And a full Jewish life can only be in Eretz Yisrael. So you've got to do almost like enough tshuva to get your appetite back. Enough tshuva to be brought back. So now the question, and now that you're back, now what? It's over? No, it can begin properly. In other words, full tshuva can only be done in Eretz Yisrael, because that's when the Jewish people can live as elite. But you've got to do enough tshuva to be brought back, and then you can do tshuva. And that's why the pasuk begins with, how does it start? B'shavtad Hashem Elokecha, b'shamata b'kulam. You're ready to listen. You're ready to listen? Okay, now you can be brought back. Which is then the ensuing psukim, b'shav Hashem Elokecha shivuscha, im yenidachcha b'kteh shamayim, and all of that. And now, tshuva can fully happen. So, in a sense, geula is the result of level one of tshuva and the enabler of level two of tshuva. It turns out, therefore, that one of the most important things to realize about geula, what we would call, is that geula does not make tshuva obsolete. It makes tshuva possible. It's a very important perspective, and without the risk of being presumptuous, it's what we're looking at, what we're going through. And this, says the Akedas Yitzchak, is really what's being communicated in those two Ma'amari Chazal. One statement of Chazal says that Tshuva mikareves es ha-geula. It brings the geula closer. But the other statement said, tshuva is smucha le-geula. It's close by to geula. Are those two ways of saying the same thing? No, they're actually talking about two different stages. The gedola tshuva shemikareves es ha-geula is that first stage of tshuva which brings the geula close. But then there's more tshuva to do. Because now that you're back in Eretz Yisrael, now you can do full tshuva. Because that's where it's going to happen, in Eretz Yisrael. And therefore, when the second statement says, tshuva is smucha le-geula, it's nearby to geula, meaning it follows closely on the heels of geula. It's no longer about bringing geula close. Geula has happened, and then tshuva has to happen. Samuch to that. So this is an amazing analysis of these psukim. Because it turns out that the geula, that the initial geula, it's like an in-between stage. It's follow something, but it's meant to lead into something else. And that means really there's food for thought really for everyone. Certainly when it comes to the parsha of Nitzavim, which is the parsha of geula, which is the parsha of what we're looking towards, someone who lives not in Eretz Yisrael cannot allow himself to forget that the Jewish people ultimately are meant to be in Eretz Yisrael. But someone who does live in Eretz Yisrael can also not allow himself to think that as soon as he lives in Eretz Yisrael, it's done, it's finished. Because on the contrary, now things are ready to happen. And anyone who thinks that the geula has been completed just needs to turn on the radio or open a newspaper and you'll see. There is yet much to be done, but it will be done, and it will be done here. And that's what we're looking forward to, and that's what the psukim are describing according to the Akedas Yitzchak. We should see all of these stages through to their completion until we have the final geula.
Gentlemen, we have a minion. We see